All right, folks, we are back on the FlagStick.com T-Top Podcast. Masters Week. My name is Stefan Tudor. Not playing at the Masters. Neither is my co-host, Scott McLeod. How are you today?
I'm pretty good for November. Masters Week. Still nice outside here in Canada, at least this part of Canada. We can still have some golf weather, so there's not much to complain about, really.
Yeah, we can. We got out, actually.
We did.
For 17 holes. I believe after 17, I might have been beating you. I don't know. It's inconclusive. But we did 17 holes. It was fun. It was nice to say, hey, there's my final loop for sure. And I'm not worried about it. I like to know there's closure. I have closure on the year. I felt like I was hitting the ball. I drove the ball.
You did.
The best I've driven all year on the last round. That just pissed me off. It didn't even make me happy.
Isn't this supposed to just bring you back for next year? Or is it just like tease you in the fact that, damn it, the year is over?
Oh, it's just like because I clearly found what some like a feel, right, that I've been looking for all year. And then it's like, yeah. Well, how often am I really going to keep that feel? So you and I are trying to figure out some indoor rounds and stuff like that. We'll get those going, but I'm sure people do not care what we think about our own golf rounds.
Probably not. No. But if anybody can find my range finder that I left in the fairway on the 14th hole, I'd appreciate it being returned.
Yeah, that was pretty gutty. So just quick story. Scott did the high handicap thing and left his range finder in the middle of the fairway. He's a senior. He gets a senior moment.
Exactly.
Left it bright orange range finder, middle of the fairway. Immediately on the next hole, you know, you hit your tee shot. You don't need it. So one other shot, or maybe two other shots if you count a putt, were hit between you leaving it there and going back. And the minute you went back, nope, never saw it. Doesn't exist. Of course not. Of course, no. The orange rangefinder dug its way into the ground and is going to make a tree that, you know, sprouts more rangefinders. And it's just
I hope
like,
so.
Yeah, just
it was pretty sad, actually. You get, you know, 16 guys that I actually talked to behind us, and they're all shaking their heads like 5-year-olds. Like, nope, I didn't take it. I didn't take it. I didn't take it. But hey, whatever. It happens. So unfortunately, my mistake, right?
Well, yeah, we know who took it. We saw them. They know who they are. They probably don't listen to this podcast. They don't look like they play golf often either, but what can you do? It is Masters Week. Are we going to talk about the Houston Open? Carlos Ortiz won. I didn't think he was still alive, as you've heard on this podcast many times.
Thought he was lost in a bunker at Hilton Head.
So my theory is Ryan Palmer finally let him out, and now he's won. He's like, he's seen the light. He doesn't want to go back into the pain house of Ryan Palmer. He won. I have zero interest in talking about the golf tournament, but any thoughts at all?
You know what? Great golf course. You know, we talked about it last week as far as going in.
Tough.
Right. That move to Memorial Park scoring was not high, not, you know, really low. Ended up with three guys scoring the tournament record, including Mackenzie Hughes, 63 on Sunday. But otherwise, yeah, it was a real test for these guys. So I think that's always been the way as far as the Houston Open leading into the Masters, of course, at a different time of year. But I think just overall, third winner all time on the PGA Tour from Mexico. Just a good test, good prep coming in. DJ was in the mix. Brooks shot 65-65 on the weekend. I think those are the takeaways more than anything. 22 guys, I think, that are playing this week did make the cut. So that's a sign their games are in form. And, hey, that means we're probably going to be quite entertained this week, hopefully.
Yeah, it was nice to see Brooks kind of finish tight. Dustin Johnson finished good as well. So those guys, you know, look for them this week. Dustin, I watched his press conference today. Just stop interviewing him. Just like there's no point. The guy is, I figured out he's in on the joke.
He's definitely in on the joke. Yeah.
And he, you know, like Phil over the years, right? People just thought Phil was, you know, this nerdy, smiley dad joke. And like Phil's been in on the joke the whole time. I'm starting to realize Dustin is in on the joke, though. I do not think he's all that bright. He probably has left a few range finders behind, if you catch my drift.
Yeah. For sure. I think what's funny, though, is I've got to imagine the players sitting around, you know, talking to each other going, hey, can you slip in about the fact that, you know, the best part of the Masters is liking the sandwiches? I'll give you $100 if you can make that happen.
I feel like we're going to talk about
it. It feels that way.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the food over over the episode, you know, Tiger's dinner menu for tonight as we record this earlier in the week. And we'll probably talk a little bit about it with our guest, Bob Weeks, who you know from TSN, from all the commercials. He makes sure your grips are changed and your core is engaged. I'm sure we're going to be chatting with Bobby about that. And we'll get to, you know, the dinner menu and our bets and everything as we go. But before we get even into the Masters, we want to pass our condolences on to the Trebek family. Alex Trebek, as you all know, Canadian, passed away this week at the age of 80. He was fighting pancreatic cancer, which he's had for a couple of years. Very public fight. But, you know, he's been the host of Jeopardy for the last 36 years, since 1984.
Yeah, incredible.
I don't know about you. Jeopardy was kind of, you know, always there, 7:30, 7 o'clock throughout my life. What relationship did you have with Jeopardy? Because you're kind of a trivia guy. Like, you know, you remember things better than anybody. So was Jeopardy a game that you liked watching when you were
growing? Oh, yeah. It was right up my alley because it was all about facts more than anything. I mean, I wasn't a guy that, you know, loved math and going through formulas and stuff, but I mean, useless tidbits. And I loved it. We used to have it on first thing in the day, right after school. I'd see it kind of like 4:30 or whatever, and then it'd be on later on. So I can remember being young and, you know, pulling pranks on other people and, you know, watching the episode early on, getting some of the answers and then looking extra smart. But you're right, it was just a mainstay. And I think, you know, I didn't even know he was Canadian early on, really. I didn't really know that until, you know, later on in my life. But certainly, you know, he was a comforting host, had a lot of humor about him. And definitely, you know, from a learning standpoint, I think a lot of us learned a lot of things by watching Jeopardy.
Oh, absolutely. And I still watch it every now and then. Definitely going to watch right up until his final episode, which is supposed to air on Christmas Day, which is probably going to be a little heavy, as it sounds like he does have a sign off at the end. And he was aware that this is probably the last one he was going to film. But we'll get to that one day when we get to it. And I want to celebrate, you know, what Jeopardy's done with us and for us. And with you, you are the golf trivia nerd. You remember everything. So what I've done is I've actually set up 9 Jeopardy style questions. And actually all these questions came from actual episodes of Jeopardy and golf questions that came from Jeopardy that Alex Trebek himself would have asked over the years. You have not looked at these questions. I assume we're going with Scout's honor that you have not looked at the answers.
No, I looked quickly to see them and I was like, oh boy, I better really think about this one.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to ask them. You do have to answer them in Jeopardy style. And I do want you to give, like, let's give 5 seconds. I'll give you 5 seconds to think before you answer. I do want the audience to maybe play along a little bit and see if they can get the answers as they go along. These are difficult. I gave my wife this quiz last night. Promptly went 0-9.
Wow.
0-9. And there are some layups in here, but most of these they're definitely tough. So are you ready for Jeopardy?
I think I am.
All right, hit the music. All right. So this first question, this term for an unidentified aircraft or missile, or sorry, this term for an unidentified aircraft or missile is also used on the golf course. Remember you have to answer in Jeopardy style.
All right. Well, I'm thinking it through, though, before I answer here. I mean, I know Ken Jennings. I can't just, you know, ream off 74 wins in a row as far as shows are concerned here. But thinking bogey doesn't, I know, UFO. Well, my dad was military and he was in the Air Force. So I'm going to go with, what is a bogey?
That is correct.
Nice.
That is correct. All right. Number 2, an advantage in golf or a disadvantage through lack?
Oh boy. Advantage in golf or a disadvantage through lack. What is distance?
That is, what is a handicap?
All right.
See, this is where Jeopardy, this is what always got me. The wording of Jeopardy is yeah. If they actually wrote it out a different way, you'd probably get it, but it's the wording, the wordplay. All right. I think you got this one. Number three, tiny sharp teeth give this plant its name, also an elite Florida golf course.
If I had not played this golf course, it might be a little bit more difficult, but having spent some time in that area, what is Sawgrass?
That is correct. Sawgrass, as we all know, the home of the Players Championship. See, look at this. I'm ready to take over. Number four, a golf tourney was the scene of a catch made by this seabird, also the name of a tilt rotor hybrid aircraft.
Seabird. Okay, so going back to that, I can remember the Players Championship, like a seagull sort of thing, grab the ball or whatever. So let's go. What is albatross?
That is incorrect. We were looking for osprey. That's a difficult one. Now yeah. We're probably going way back, but we'll move along. I feel like you got this, knowing your roots. An old joke says that golf was invented by the same people who think that music comes out of these.
I know this one. I know this fairly well because obviously, as you said, my Scottish roots. What is bagpipes?
That is correct. I like that one. My wife guessed the recorder. is what she said. Number six. Slogan created in 1921 when a pal of an R.J. Reynolds ad man ran out of cigarettes on a golf course.
Slogan created in 21. A pal of. Oh, boy. Well, contrary to what you believe, I wasn't alive in 1921.
It is a pretty famous slogan for a brand of cigarettes.
Created him in a pal and ran out of cigarettes. I only got 5 seconds, right? I've got nothing.
The answer is, what is I'd walk a mile for a camel?
Oh my.
So that's where that saying came from. Camel cigarettes, right. Which would have been the huge brand back in the day, right? Like he ran out of his golf course, he would have walked a mile to get some.
Gotcha.
All right. Three more questions. Stretcher bearer is a slang expression for one of these golf helpers.
I think we've both been a stretcher bearer at times, especially when you don't get to make the weekend. So I'm going to go, what is a caddy?
That is correct. It is a great term. I figured you'd get that.
That's awesome.
One. That is a layup. Number eight, Rudyard Kipling painted golf balls this color to find them on snow-covered greens in Vermont.
Ooh, well, obviously white wouldn't work too well. So let's go something. You know what? They're greens. Maybe the green would show up. What is green?
That is incorrect. We're looking for what is red. This is not probably, this is probably the first person that tried different colored golf balls for some reason. I don't know where you would even, you're pretty much throwing a random color out there.
Yeah, pretty much.
So that one was new to me. And I think you got this one. This is our last one. Golfers know it means to lay the club behind the ball in penetration to hit it.
In what?
Oh, wow. Penetration. I meant preparation. A little Freudian slip there.
I'll go.
Those are from my roots.
Wow. I'll go, what is address the ball?
That is correct. So those are supposed to be some of the hardest questions that Jeopardy asked golf-wise over the years.
That's funny.
Which, you know, thanks to Alex for these years. I know he was a little bit of a golfer in his day as well. Playing Jeopardy had a huge effect. And Scotty, you did pretty well. I wouldn't quit your day job. And I would not quit my day job on hosting when you can't read certain words. We're going to talk a lot about the Masters this episode. But before we do, I think, why don't we use the guy that's on site? Let's start there. Let's head to Augusta National right now. Bob Weeks is on site with our buddy James Duthie and all the TSN crew doing the international broadcast up here in Canada. You can watch them all week on TSN. So why don't we head down to Augusta National, see what's going on with Bobby and the crew, and see what stories he has for the upcoming week at the Masters in November in 2020.
All right, we want to welcome to the podcast patriarch, one of the patriarchs of Canadian golf media. Oh, he's wincing at hearing that. Obviously a familiar name for anybody who follows golf in Canada, a guy I've gotten to know quite well over the years, and we're happy that he's joining us here from Augusta National Golf Club, not the club itself, but getting ready to cover the Masters. Bob Weeks from TSN, the senior golf analyst. How you doing, Bob?
Doing great. It's kind of almost surreal to be down here in Augusta. It took us It was a long route to get down here, but it was it's great. This is my 25th Masters, and I guess patriarch. I don't know. That's a big term. Someone else called me venerable this week, so I guess I'm becoming an old guy. That's all I can figure out.
Yeah, when it turns into words that most youths these days wouldn't understand, you've hit that mark.
Exactly.
For starters, I mean, you say about a long route to get there. You guys had an unusual path to get there this year. Why don't you tell our listeners why you guys decided to do what you did and what it was all about? I mean, how did it turn out for you guys?
Well, this all kind of came together maybe about 2 months ago. We knew at some point we were going to have to get back on the road. We knew we were going to have to do something. The Masters is one of the biggest properties we have at TSN, next to the Super Bowl, and the Super Bowl is on CTV. So it's the Masters actually. But we thought it would be great if we could get down there. So we thought of a way, and I won't take any credit for this. When I say we, it's like the royal we. There were some smart people who put together a plan. And essentially, at first we were turned down, and then the Bell executive said, okay, look, let's try it. And so we're the first people from Bell Media to travel south of the US. And it basically involved, we got two tests before we left. So we had one week and then one the next week. And then we got on a bus, and it's not like the yellow school bus or the magic bus or anything like that. It's sort of like a touring bus that maybe you'd see with a rock band would have or something. It had bunks in it. It had satellite TV that almost worked once in a while when we were down there. And there was eight of us plus two drivers. And we made the 17 or 18 hour trip from Toronto. We had about a 2.5 hour stop at the border, which was absolutely barren. There was nobody there. And we got in, and as media, there is a category as essential workers. I'm not sure we really are, but we were in that category. So that allowed us to go over, but it was pretty strict and pretty rigorous. And then drove right here. And the only place we're allowed to go is here in the golf course. We're not allowed to go out for dinner. We're not allowed to go out to the grocery store. Everything's being delivered. So it's kind of fun so far. It's only been a few days, but we'll take it. We're here.
Are those rules set by the government or Bell Media, and just making sure that you, the talent, are all safe?
We are. Those rules were put in place by Bell Media. Obviously, some of the rules crossing the borders and things like that were in government issued. And when we come back, we'll have to quarantine for 14 days, which is a Canadian government stipulation, obviously, but that was a small price to pay to come down here. And I've been working at my home like most people since March anyway, so I don't even really know much difference other than I can't go play golf, and I think golf season's over. So
Well, I was saying, it would seem kind of appropriate, being that it's a November Masters, kind of, when a junior hockey season normally, it seemed appropriate you guys were going down on a bus. How was it traveling with those guys? Duthie, obviously, he's been on this podcast before, but I mean, these are guys that a team that but, it's always different when you travel together, as we know. Sometimes traveling together can be a little dicey. So how was it as far as the ride itself?
It was pretty good. We had a good cast of characters. I would say that we've all worked together. We've all done the Masters together before. Graham Dillette, who's our analyst, came in from Houston. But for the rest of us on the bus, the first four and a half, five hours was kind of really fun. Everybody was up. It was energy. And then you kind of drift off a little bit. People get tired. And as I said, we took little naps during the day in the bunk. And there may have been one or two beers consumed during the trip as well, but It was okay. It was fun. I mean, it wasn't the easiest road I've ever had, but it was kind of a cool experience to be down there. We'll see what it's like coming home, because we're going to basically drive through the night after the tournament's over. So that may be a little bit different.
So that's the plan once everything wraps up Sunday, just hop right back in after all your hits are done and try to get home as soon as possible on Monday, back up in Canada, get the quarantine back going.
Yeah, that's essentially what we're trying to do right now. It's you know, the tournament's been moved up. The Sunday finish will be around 2:30, 3:30. So we're hoping to get on the road maybe by 6. We have a post-game show to do. I think everybody wants to have a quick shower before we get stuffed into a bus for 18 hours again. We'll see what happens at the border this time.
Well, before we get into the actual week, okay. I do want to know, you mentioned Dillette is down there with you. We'll just kind of wrap up the Houston Open last week. He unfortunately did have to withdraw, citing, you know, his back injury. Have you got any updates from him on how he's feeling? Or is it just he's still, everything we've always heard from him is like, you never know each day. So what has he told you so far?
So he basically said he probably could have kept playing, but he could feel the kind of familiar pains that he knows. And he wants to get a couple more tournaments in, you know, either late this year, or early next year. So he thought, you know, just to be safe, I'm going to withdraw from this tournament. And so far when he's been here, if there is a piece of equipment or some kind of apparatus that will help your body heal, he has it. He's got a big suitcase full of magic tricks and things. He's been rolling around and doing all sorts of stuff. So I think he's okay. I mean, I wasn't sure if he was going to be able to sit in the broadcast for 8 hours or so, but he seems to be good, and he plans to play it in a couple of weeks.
Now, you've had other players before, you know, help out, be it Brad Fritsch or Thomas Bjorn or whatever the case may be, but what's that add to you guys for the broadcast to have that player perspective? I know Graham obviously doesn't have the deepest experience in the Masters, but he has played in the Masters. But you know, what does that add to the broadcast for you guys?
Well, it adds a little bit of authenticity. I mean, he knows these players on a different level than I do or James does. You know, I think being a player, you can kind of relate. We have a little piece that's running during the broadcast at some point about what it was like to play as a first timer, and kind of pointing a little bit towards some of the first timers this year who are very good, like Colin Morikawa or a guy like a Nick Taylor, who's a fellow Canadian who's playing for the first time. So, you know, we don't have those kind of experience. We can't relate to that. And that's what Graham can bring for us. He is already a fabulous broadcaster. He will be a very good broadcaster if that's what he wants to do. He's not afraid to kind of say things that are strong, and he's got some good perspectives on things. And he's a well-liked guy on the tour as well. So I think players will confide in him and tell him what's going on and give him the real goods, as opposed to sometimes where they might just put on a smiley face and say, oh yeah, I love this golf course or something. So I'm really looking forward to working with him this week.
Who is going to be wearing the tighter shirt, Graham or James?
I don't know. Every time before they go out to do a hit, they have these weights and they keep pumping up a little bit, you know, pumping their arms up, and then they go out with their tight shirts and stuff. So I'm the loose guy. I'm the old guy with the t-shirt.
It looks like James throws the shirt in the dryer before each day, gets it nice and nice and tight going out there. You did mention, though, the first timers. You have played the golf course at Augusta, and so has James. I think this is the question anytime someone's played Augusta, we always have talked about it. So thinking back, you know, what has that experience been like for you playing that golf course?
You know, it was a long wait for me to get onto the golf course. I did it in my 18th year.
Wow.
And I had to wait, and every year it became almost funny. There was people I didn't know on social media who would you know, wait with anticipation to find out if this was the year that I finally got it. So when you do get on there, I mean, they treat you so well. You come down Magnolia Lane, they give you a spot in the champions locker room. They were very good. They knew I was a Canadian, so they gave me Mike Weir's locker. You have breakfast, you go out in the rain, you meet your caddy, and then you know, and then off you go. And it's almost surreal. As I say, I had walked around 18 years of walking, and you know where everything's happened. But even still, as many times as I'd walked those holes, being inside the ropes, the perspective that I got of the golf course was just that much different and that much better. And you're pumped, even though it was the first round I'd played, you know, since November 4. I played great golf, for me anyway. didn't have a four putt, which is great. And I just thought I thought it was a really cool experience that The guys, some other guys who had played warned me. They said, you know, when you start getting to like 17 or 18, you're going to sit there and go, can't believe this is like, this is almost over. And it was a sad finish, but it was great to play it.
Has it changed the way you actually do your hits and look at broadcasting when you are there? Any like spots that you think back on that are different from just walking the golf course that you've actually played it?
The two that stand out for me were the third hole. I was shocked at even of looking at. I was shocked at how thin that green is. It's just not deep at all, and there's a lot more runoff than I thought. Like trying to hit that green with anything other than a wedge is just about impossible. And then on 16, I couldn't believe the slope between the right side and the left side. How big that is when it comes down. I hit my shot up that way, and I was hoping it was going to come back down, but it stayed up there. And my caddy says, ooh, you got no chance on the next one. So the slope to come down is really, really something else. It's just a diabolical shot if you get stuck up there. But, and you know, just little things like, some of the slopes on the greens and some of the, like the seventh green is almost ridiculous, beyond ridiculous. When you're actually playing it, as opposed to just looking at it, I think you get a better feel for some of those things.
So, I mean, talking about the course itself, I mean, right now you haven't had the ability to get out to the course. You're still waiting for test results and things to get out there. But what are you hearing as far as differences this year? Obviously, November, different time of year. We're expecting some rain this week as well. What are your thoughts as far as the course and how it might be different this week versus other years?
We've talked to a lot of people, and basically, you know, the first difference, of course, is there's no patrons there. So that's this golf course more than any golf course anywhere, golf tournament anywhere, is really defined by the fans and the roars, and you hear it. Corey Connors made an interesting point to me today. He said, you know, it's not only that the players feed off it, he says the announcers feed off it. I mean, think of Vern Lundquist, you know, maybe, yes, sir, and how pumped up they get. So you really miss a lot without the fans. That's the biggest difference. The second difference, of course, is there's no grandstands. There's no ropes this year. They have no gallery ropes up. They've actually drawn a line, kind of painted a line along the sides of all the holes. The people who are allowed to be out there are media and the spouses, but they've drawn a line there where you're supposed to stay behind. There's a couple of concession stands open for volunteers where you can get a sandwich or something like that. And most of those are, and that's free, actually. It's all free. No souvenirs, obviously. So there's just the look, I think, is the look and the sound will be the big differences, I think, for everybody. Even if you're watching at home, it's going to be a little bit more something we're not used to. And getting back to the grandstands, I said there's no grandstands. Some of the players will use those grandstands because there's always in the same place as sight lines, as target lines. So you have to pick a few new lines as well. So there's some differences out there. In terms of the weather, yeah, it's as we're recording this right now, it is raining here in Augusta, and I think it might stop like a week Tuesday or something. It's supposed to be raining pretty much most of the week. Thursday, I think, is going to be the worst of the days. It's supposed to come down fairly heavy, so we'll see what happens. Most of the players have been telling me that it's pretty soft already on the fairways, so it's going to get softer. It's going to get longer. The greens, of course, they have those sub-air things where they can make them as firm and as dry as they really want to a point, I think. But I think we're in for a pretty soggy one here, and I would be very surprised if there's not a lot of stops and stuff with the forecast I see.
Which is unfortunate, just already being in a weird year and having to have all that happen on top of it when, you know, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience to see Augusta National in November and have a Masters in November. So let's say it gets off to a rough start on Thursday with a lot of rain, and usually rain comes wind. Who do you think gets the benefit out of that type of atmosphere out there and that type of weather that will actually potentially help them in the long run of the tournament?
Well, I think the guys who benefit the most are the longer hit. They're still going to be long. I think the guys who lose out the most are the kind of the middle hitters, the guys who think about going for a green in two, but now there's probably no chance. I heard a good line today. We were talking about Bryson DeChambeau, of course, you know, how far he's going to get. He's going to have a huge said. Someone said Bryson DeChambeau is going to be the first guy to play the Masters and hit every par five of the wedge since Zach Johnson. Of course, Zach Johnson was doing it in three shots. Bryson is doing it in two shots. But I think the advantage always goes to the longer hitter. But, you know, who knows at this golf course? The year that Mike won, it was a rainy, soggy time in the first couple of days. And I think he had to play like, trying to think how many holes he had to play on the Friday, but it was more than 18. It was a long day. And I remember Darren Clark was playing with him, and he couldn't believe how Mike Weir wasn't tired. He was exhausted. Darren Clark was just like staggering up the 18th hole. Mike Weir, because he was in great shape, had taken advantage of that and moved up the leaderboard considerably.
Speaking of Mike, I mean, his game is obviously in a different shape than it has been in the last couple of years. He's playing now on a regular basis on PGA Tour Champions. He's been playing well. What are you expecting out of him this week?
Well, he's pumped. You know, he said this is the most excited he's been in a long time to come to the Masters. He said that the only thing right now that he would like to improve is his putting, and that's usually his strong suit. And so I think that if Mike Weir can put – if the rest of Mike Weir's game is pretty good and he gets the putter going, I mean – you know, well, let's not kid ourselves. He's not going to win another green jacket. But I think making it to the weekend would be great. I think he's only done it once in about the last 10 years. He'd like to play on the weekend and just, you know, just show well, prove that he's still capable of putting some good rounds together. Because I've walked out here with him, and it's just, you just kind of cringe. I remember one year he was paired with Brant Snedeker, and Snedeker came to me under the tree and said, I got to tell you something. Says if Mike Weir didn't have the greatest short game in the world, he probably wouldn't have broken 100 today. Wow. So, I mean, I give credit to Mike for battling, trying to find a game again, for going through all the healing and working and trying to get his himself to back to respectability. And he's done it. And I think he's weak this week.
Let's go to the other side of things for a guy that on the Champions Tour looks like he's going to, you know, compete with Bernhard Langer for the most amount of wins of all time and Phil Mickelson. But on the PGA Tour, it looks like he couldn't find a fairway if we were playing St. Andrews. So what are your thoughts about Phil going into this week, and specifically about this idea of him throwing in a 47.5-inch driver on top of the fact he couldn't find a fairway with a 45-inch just a mere week ago?
It's never boring covering Phil. You know, he is something else, and he, you know, he can play once in a while, but I think when you look at what they do on the Champions Tour with wider fairways, they don't tuck the pins all that much, really speaking. You know, the distances are still pretty good, but it's a whole different class. And so I think you can compete like Phil can on the Champions Tour, but I think he's, you know, I think his best before date, we may be looking at sort of the end of the really legitimate chances that Phil has if they have passed him. I think to a certain extent, maybe Tiger too, but Phil, you know, Phil 50 and as hard as he's working to stay in shape and all that, I'm just not sure that game is there anymore, even though he does, you know, he has the distance to get it around Augusta National, which a lot of the older guys don't. And he's once in a while in touch with his putter that he can do it, but he'd have to play some pretty inspired golf, I think, to get into competition on Sunday.
We'll get into three other players now who might have a little better chance than maybe, you know, the other two that we just mentioned. But we look at the group of Canadians that are playing. You mentioned in your column that, you know, this is the first time there's been four Canadians in the Masters since 1965. You know, and the fact that obviously Mike Weir is here, Corey Connors, Adam Hadwin, and Nick Taylor, they played a practice round today. What are your expectations as far as that group is concerned, how they'll play the golf course? You know, Nick Taylor obviously is a rookie, and who you think will shine among them?
Boy, that's a hard question to ask. I was saying to Graham Dillette before, I said, you know, if you could put a composite of all three games into one person, you'd have a great player. I mean, Corey is so accurate off the tee, so accurate into the greens. Adam is, generally speaking, a pretty good putter. Nick can get it out there with a little bit of distance, and he's grit and some short game. Right now, I think Adam, to me, is the one that I would put money on if I had to. He's been telling me that he's so frustrated by finishing 40th and 38th and stuff over the last couple of months. He hasn't played poorly necessarily, but he's been making a lot of cuts, but he just hasn't been in competition. And he sort of took a step back and realized, maybe I'm just working a little bit too hard. Maybe I'm diagnosing myself a little bit too deeply. Maybe I just need to step back and get out of my own way and have some fun. And I think I agree with that. I think that's, having seen him a little bit this year, I think that's what I think is probably best for Adam Hadwin. And he, you know, is it a good place to do that here at Augusta National in a major? Maybe not, but I think you can have a little bit of fun and relax a little bit, not let the bad shots eat you up quite as much. Having said that, Corey's got some good stuff going from the last little bit. And so he's also told me that really his problem has been not so much physical, but just bad decision-making, which is unusual for him because he's a pretty intelligent guy. But he went and met with Derek Ingram and they talked about it. And he's just a little bit more confident, a little bit more relaxed, I think, in pulling the right club and deciding what to do on certain shots than he was, let's say, a month or 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, and I we know his caddy quite well on this podcast, Kyle, and Kyle and him are they. It sounds like they got quite the game plan going in there, and they're dialed in. And I like your thought about Adam as well, just going out and having fun. And I think you actually do have a good point though about this being a place where I think you can go out and have fun. It's a lot harder when you're on the grind of the PGA Tour season. You played 3 weeks in a row, and now I'm in Houston. Right. And I'm playing this Muni course, which is a great golf course. Right. But no, now I'm at Augusta and I feel young. And even though I might be tired, I can get through another 4 days and be excited about, you know, playing golf. And I think that is important and probably is good for guys like Adam Hadwin. But over your years, you know, been there 25 years, you said now, who when they get to Augusta from the player's standpoint, just almost it's like they turn back the clock for you. They're giddy. They look like it's their first time every single time and just a joy to be around every single year.
Man, you could just say the whole field because you never see too many guys who are obviously, I mean, Freddie Couples is a guy who just seems to play so well there, even though he's got the bad back and he's always complaining about always games no good and he hasn't played much, but then he comes out and shoots 68 or something. I mean, he's one of those guys. Webb Simpson is a guy who, you know, grew up not too far away and played some golf here in college and as a junior and stuff. And he just loves to walk around this place and he'll tell you stories and point things out, talk to you about it after the round and stuff. And I think that he's a guy who's, you know, I don't know if he's got the length to do what he needs to do around here, but he just loves to play Augusta National. I know that. And there's not, off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody. I mean, Bernard Langer is another guy who was, what was he in the hunt, I think 2 years ago or something, or even last year maybe. So there's lots of guys who seem to find a way to play well here, whether it's because they know the golf course or it's because they just get inspired by what they see because, you know, they've played here so many times. Whatever the reason is, I think there are fewer surprises here at the top of the leaderboard than in any other majors, because the guys who are, you know, you can kind of go through the usual suspects, as I like to call it, and probably find your winners 9 years out of 10 here.
So that said, who do you think you're going to be interviewing Sunday night?
Well, I guess the odds on favorite people would say Bryson DeChambeau. And when you see what he's hitting into some of these greens, I mean, it's just insane what he's saying. Wedge in the first hole. I mean, I remember when guys would be lucky if they could get it up to the top of the hill. That was a big thing. I remember about maybe 7 or 8 years ago looking at the second hole, being down by the green, looking back up and seeing Gary Woodland hit a ball like over the top of the hill. And I thought, like, nobody's ever done that before. How can they do that? And so I don't know. It's Bryson. What Bryson's got going right now, I think the one thing that people overlook a little bit is that, you know, he's more than a big hitter. He's got lots of different things that he's thinking about, lots of different things that he's doing. Graeme Bellette brought up a good point where he said, you know, I'm not sure if he's got the creativity to handle these greens. You know, he's a very looking putter. That setup he's got looks sort of like a robot when he's putting. But he's going to be an interesting one. I wouldn't be surprised if he's around. I'm kind of leaning towards two other guys. I'm leaning toward Dustin Johnson. I think that his game personality suit this tournament because nothing really seems to bother him, so you don't get too upset about it. And you look at his record coming in here, he is last six starts, right? Second, first, sixth, second. So, I mean, he's got that. The one thing that scares me a little bit about him is that he's become sort of a devotee, he and his brother, to the greens reading book, and there's going to be no greens reading books here at Augusta National. They won't allow him. And the other guy I think is coming in sort of, if you can, the end of the radar is Rory McIlroy. And Rory, I think, has put so much pressure on himself over the years to try to round out this career Grand Slam. And this year, having the baby and being distracted by that and diapers to change and feedings in the middle of the night and things. I think maybe he's just a little bit more relaxed and it doesn't quite mean as much as it has in the past. He sort of said as much today in the press conference that he was at. So I think those are the two guys that I'm looking at.
I really like that Webb Simpson drop. I think that it might be, he might just sneakily sneak in there onto Sunday, and he's going to pick, like, and he's played great, right, all year. And I feel like he's just that guy that, you know, it's that layer just below the Rorys, the DJs, the Brysons, just because of his personality too. He's very, you know, nonchalant and just, you know, happy-go-lucky. And then all of a sudden, like, if he has the green jacket on Sunday, I would not be surprised. And I can't believe it's just completely gone over my head. I really like that thought process, Bob. I do have to ask you though, on Bryson, do you think almost too many people have put the pressure on at this point? Like, everyone has him as the favorite. He has himself as the favorite, which should be the least shocking thing we've said all day. But, like, you know, we're talking about where he's hitting it and all these things. Like, I have a wedge here, an 8-iron at this par 5, right? Like, at some point, could it go too far in that, like, he gets out there and he can't even find anything and it just goes completely squirrely? Like, do you even see that as an option based on how he's played this year?
I mean, it's always an option. You know, talking to some of the caddies and a couple of players today, they're amazed by what he's doing. But around here, you know, it doesn't take you can't really get yourself in too much trouble off the tee. There are a number of holes where you can, but not a lot of them. But if he does, you know, he could have a big error. Like if he tries to go for 13 over the top and doesn't make it, you know, the drop zone is basically 20 feet in front of the tee. So if you don't cross the hazard line at the other end, so there's a few danger spots for him as well. And I think, you know, his confidence in himself and his ability is strong. And that's a big thing, I think, around here. I think you've got to kind of believe in yourself. Rory said that when he fell apart, he basically just tried to be someone else that he wasn't. So it'll be a big test for Bryson. But if he does win this one, then I think he moves up into a different class. Now he's a two-time major champion. And there's a back-to-back, and there's a lot of stuff going on now. You see people now starting to chase distance, right? I mean, Rory's asking a little bit, Dustin a little bit, and the college ranks are going crazy with guys trying to swing it like Bryson. So, I mean, if he does win this one, it could be a real game-changer for the sport.
At what point, though, does it get, you know, beyond annoying for the other players? I mean, if you look at the press conferences today, Justin Thomas probably answered more questions about Bryson than he did about him. You know, they expect it. You know, there's a lot of us in the media side of it looking for a story and trying to milk the story that's popular at this time. But you got to think a bunch of the players, you know, at some point they're just going to say, you know what, I want to talk about me or something else and not Bryson.
It's like, goes back to the old Tiger Phil days when every press conference that Phil went into, he was asked about Tiger. Yeah, I think there's something to that for sure, Scott. You know, I think I won't say from, you know, Bryson's not universally loved on the PGA Tour. I will say that.
Can confirm.
and people have told me off the record, you know, a few stories about this and that. So, but I do think they kind of respect what he's doing in terms of he's playing within the rules. He's just trying to find a way to be as good as he can. And he thinks he can do it through science. But, you know, John Daly was almost the same kind of phenom when he came out on the tour. Everyone said, oh, everyone's going to start swinging it like John Daly. And that didn't happen either. So we do have to temper our expectations a little bit and our realities a little bit. He's good for the game in terms of people are talking about him. But you're right. I think there's a certain point where we have to say, okay, let's just calm down here and see what physically he can do. He might throw his back out tomorrow and never play again.
Well, let's close out with something that I know is important to you. It is an important week in the world, not just for the Masters, but Remembrance Day. I know that is a big thing for you. Why is it so important for you to remember our soldiers and everybody who keeps all the rest of us safe in the world?
Yeah, it's weird. We were thinking today how normally when we come to Augusta, it's the anniversary of Vimy Ridge. In April, and now we're doing Remembrance Day, and yeah, it's like, you know, it's a like Scott, it's, you know, I've got a military background in my family. My father, or my grandfather, I should say, fought in both the First and Second World War. He was in the battles and those horrible ones at Vimy Ridge and Passchendaele and Ypres and the Somme and all those terrible things in the World War, and was decorated very high. After the war finished, he decided to stay in the business and became a career military guy. At the end of the second, he fought in the Second World War too. Didn't fight, but he was higher up ranks. He was mostly, I guess, his biggest contribution was in the Canadians in Italy. He helped take that, and he, end of the Second World War, became the Chief of Defense. He was what is now the Chief of Defense. It wasn't called that back then, but he was in charge of the Canadian Armed Forces. So very distinguished, very highly decorated guy, and a guy who I got to know. He was around for quite a while. I think he died when I was about 27 or so. And so I really, really enjoyed spending time with him and hearing his stories. And then afterwards, you know, going over to Vimy Ridge, going over to the trenches, and you can take the battlefield tours. And they're so, so impactful. And if any Canadian has a chance to go over and see Vimy Ridge or some of the things like that, that really is something very Canadian, even though it's in a foreign country. So on the other side is, you know, their Second World War veterans are getting older. They're disappearing. My girlfriend's father is at Sunnybrook Veterans Hospital there. And he was a, he flew in the Lancasters, and he was a mid gunner. So that little bubble on top of the Lancasters, he was up in there. And when you think about those guys, you know, there was a 50% chance that you were going to come back when you took off. So, I mean, I don't even know how people got into those planes and made that, but thank goodness for us that they did.
Yeah, I guess the worlds intersected at Ancaster when we watched the Lancasters fly over as we stood out there. Thank you, Bob. Thank you for coming on. Really appreciate that. We're also very glad that not only are you doing great things in golf and curling, but, you know, you lend your voice and your influence as far as remembering our soldiers as well. So good luck. Have a great week in Augusta National, and also good luck with that bus ride back.
Yeah.
Before you go, Bob, I forgot to mention, we have one, your biggest fan. My buddy is your biggest fan, and he has one question, and he just says, how does he engage his core to look like Bob Weeks?
waiting for something like that. You guys weren't going to laugh about that.
he also was hoping you could take a look at his golf grip if you have time.
Hey, listen, you guys, everyone remembers those ads, so they're effective, right? And, I've been pretty lucky to be aligned with two good companies, Just for Men. My hair is, you guys are seeing my hair.
It looks great. And obviously I would know what good hair looks like.
And Asante, which has put out some of those great, I mean, listen, this is a great year for Asante for the courses that we featured. Cobble Beach said it was just a home run for them to have that add on, but we're pretty lucky to engage with some of those clients and be able to do those commercials. They're, I guess they're working because everyone remembers them.
Yeah, well, as I said, you got a big fan. I told him I'd try to get a signed photo for him one day here. So we'll look.
Well, my next trip, I'll sign it for him.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Thanks, Bob. We really appreciate all you've done.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, thank you, Bob Weeks, for that interview. I got to say, Scott, my core is, it's ready. I'm ready to go play golf. He walks us. No, he didn't actually walk us through any exercises. We tried to get him to do it, but he wasn't willing. Bobby, clearly an expert on Augusta National. We love Bobby on this podcast, that's for sure.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Been privileged to get to know him over the years, travel with him and so forth. And, you know, always brings great stories from Augusta. And, you know, even though this week's a little bit different than normal, always great to hear from him.
I love it. So where do you want to start on the Masters this week? You know, we talked a lot about it with Bob, and we're going to go over, you know, we're going to do our own bet or our own draft that we do each week. But what's the first storyline that's popped out to you so far this week, being that it's in November?
Well, I think the funniest thing, I mean, obviously a lot of people are talking about the conditions of the golf course, which I don't think are much of a story. A few of the players are referring to, you know, the way some of the grass is around the edges of the greens and stuff like that, causing some issues with chipping and so forth. But I don't think there's a lot to talk about as far as the golf course. The only thing that's going to really impact that is the weather this week. We're going to see a fair bit of moisture down there. So that could have an effect as far as, you know, who can contend and so forth. But I think, you know, I hate to start with one player,
but I think I'm going to start with one player because of a particular reason. All the press conferences I've been watching so far, they're asking more questions about this player than the players that are right in front of them, which, you know, I hate to give my brethren heck, but it's kind of sad to actually sit there and I get it. There's storylines, there's demands for it. You know, even Phil said, hey, Bryson is a lightning rod right now for people paying attention to the game. But the number of questions that players like JT and Tiger and Phil are getting about Bryson, and not about them, I think one is disrespectful for them, and just ask the questions to Bryson. I mean, yeah. I know it. I guess, you know, they want their opinions on them, but you know, these guys are focused on winning for themselves more than anything.
It would be like if in that whole interview with Bob, we just asked him about James Duthie. makes no sense. Cause as you noted, like Bryson has media availability and he's a guy that will talk. So if you're going to ask, just go ask it. And I am 100% sick of it as well. So I'm sure we'll talk a lot about Bryce. I'm sure he's going to get drafted. The whole, is he going to use the 48-inch driver? Do you think he does it? I don't.
No, he's already said he's not going to be in play.
Oh, wow, because I heard earlier today he said he was unsure. And by the time this podcast comes out, we'll know for sure. But like he said, you heard 100% he's not using it after all that hype.
Yeah, he was talking about the spin numbers not being where he wanted them to be. So I think he, you know, he hasn't 100% ruled it out, but he said it's not exactly what he wants it to be. So we'll see. Could be a game time decision. And, you know, Phil's got a 47.5-inch driver in there.
That's a disaster.
I think Lou Brown.
Like, did he look at his stats from the last week? Like he didn't hit the earth.
Yeah, I think Lou Brown had the funniest tweet when he was talking about, you know, that's like giving, Stevie Wonder an Uzi. And I thought, oh my. But you know what? Adam Scott's got a 46-inch driver in there this week, and he had the longest driving average at 329 at Houston and had the longest drive in the field at 369. But, you know, again, all the other players talked about it, and I just saw a press conference with Justin Thomas, and he said, yeah, you know, that's part of his game and that's what he does. But, you know, he's not winning every single tournament. And the perception that he is, it's not. It may give him an advantage in certain areas, but as JT said, I just have to be better in other parts of my game to get back the advantage that he might get by doing that. So unfortunately, this is not a long drive contest. It is a golf contest, and the lowest score wins.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing, that, you know, Bryson's played in a bunch of tournaments. He's won two since this whole transformation, which is a lot of tournaments if you actually think about it. Two a year is big. Just a quick sidebar, when you said Lou Brown, all I think about is the coach from Major League, and now
of course that's what his Twitter name is after, right?
Not that ole, you know. love Lou Brown. Who do you think is gonna get the biggest advantage out of the conditions? I'm gonna call the conditions everything. The fact that there's no fans, the fact it's going to be soft. In your opinion, who do you think's going to actually play a huge advantage to this week?
I'm not sure. I mean, when I look at it, you know, some players obviously like to have fans there. They like the adulation. I mean, I'm talking, you know, some players are saying, you know, it helps sight lines and certain things. It's certainly not about finding golf balls. We're talking about their second cut being very little here. I think the player that just is a little bit more introverted and just kind of can go out and do their thing and not really worry about what everything else is happening around them. And, you know, DJ is obviously a player that's like that. Xander Schauffele is a perfect guy that could go and just do that and just go and, you know, take care of his business and not worry about, you know, if there's fans there or not or whatever. He's just going to start off on the first tee and see what's the lowest score he can get by the time he gets done, you know, 72 holes. So I think those introverted players, the one that, you know, probably don't spend a lot of time looking for the fans or looking for approval from the fans and, you know, with the thumbs up and the waving their hands, while, you know, a guy like Phil, this is going to be weird for him. You know, this is a guy who really plays off the fans and likes that adulation. Yeah, for sure. It's that Arnold Palmer type effect or whatever. So, you know, that's part of their DNA of what they like to do. But again, you know, Tiger could be that guy as well. You know, mentally tough, just doing his thing.
Yeah, I think that's fair. For me, I'm thinking Rory is going to play. It's going to help him a lot. And why I think this, and I'm not going to claim this as being my own take per se. I overheard it just on the background and did some research after this. But Rory's at Augusta. at the end of the year with no fans, nobody there to be like, you know, you're going to get the, you know, the career grand slam. You're going to get right. yelling at, you got this, Rory, like in the background.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hey, like all that stuff. Like I know like Rory for a while tried to play the Brooks card for a bit. Like, oh, I don't really care. And it's clear it's shown that he really does care a lot. The other reason, and I didn't actually think about this, I think this was a genius thought, is the way he's won his major championships, the golf courses, the setup at the time, they were soft. They were very soft conditions. Think about that first U.S. Open.
Congressional,
minus 16, right? Yeah. If you look at all his wins in major championships, when he went to the PGA Championship after that at Kiawah Island, was also pretty soft, and he also finished minus 13. When he won the Open Championship in 2014 at Royal Liverpool, it wasn't that it was soft, but he still won at minus 17. We know with these guys that when conditions get soft, scores go down because they can attack pins. They can go at places they usually wouldn't because it's like, hey, it's not going to roll out there. It's not going to roll out there. Rory has proven time and time again, when he gets into a shootout, the guy can come out to play. And, you know, if you look at all his wins, he actually doesn't have one win where it's even close to, single digit strokes. So just something to think about, you know, after I did a little bit of research going into it, that this might really play into his hand. What are your thoughts here on that?
Yeah, I like that. I like that theory. And, you know, in that same vein, I think DJ is a good player in that aspect as well. These are guys who carry the golf ball a long way, and they're not depending on the ground game to get there. And unlike when Zach Johnson won I guess it was 2005. I'm trying to think now.
Sure.
Anyways, whatever the case may be. I mean, that was the time when, you know, it was the windy and, you know, he had to play all the par fives and three shots and so forth. I don't think this is that type of situation. I think it's the one where, you know, that bomber that carries the ball, and not talking about the player who, you know, hits it a long way but rolls it out more. Maybe a Matt Wolf, can hit it a long way, but he doesn't necessarily carry it. And that said, he's a rookie going into this, and that can be another point of discussion here and talking about.
Yeah, that's just a heads up right now. I'm throwing some sprinkles on Matt Wolf missed cut this week.
Yeah, I mean, oh, well, there you go. So, I mean, that's a tough go as a rookie. But like you said, that style of game, I think, is important. Having that experience is important. As long as Rory's putter cooperates, that's going to be the difference. And
which
that
I was
is,
watching Golf Channel today. If. He was on the putting green. He had like a four-footer. Same four-footer four times. He missed it four times in a row.
Yeah.
And I was
exactly why I mentioned it. Eat a green, gold.
But
if you can't get the ball in the hole,
yeah,
it's going to be tough to do. This is Augusta National. These are not, you know, flat greens. These are not even bumpy tour greens. These greens are ridiculous. And you've got to understand that even if the golf course is soft, they've got the sub-air system that was invented there and is used there very liberally. These greens will not be soft at all.
But, hey, I still have a theory there. Maybe we'll see if we get to it in the bet. But you are correct, Rory. But the thing about Rory's putter, you never know when it comes, right? It's not like it just shows up. And I don't know if it's just a reading the greens right or something. I don't know what it is, but I like his chances. DJ's a great call out from the going low side of things. This guy in his last four Masters, he started top 10 in all four, missed the cut in 2014, only missed the cut once, and in 2013 was T13. So, like, watch out for DJ.
Yeah. I think the key for Rory is the fact that he's a very aggressive putter. So I think the key for him is not going to be so much his putter, because he can make those putts. It's going to be his iron control into the greens. And if he can control it so that he can stay below the ball or below the hole or stay on the right side of the hole, he can play his aggressive putts, and that's when he'll score. That's a big thing for him. So I'd say keep an eye on that as far as his approaches to the greens. And if he can do that well and he can control those iron distances, he will score very well here.
Yeah, he's, just in the last five, six appearances, you know, same thing, five for six in top tens. He hasn't been great coming out of the restart after COVID, but I'm looking forward to watching Rory this week, that's for sure. Any other thoughts, guys, stories that popped out for you this week? Obviously, Brooks Koepka being back is huge. I don't know what to expect out of Brooks this week, but he looks to be in the right frame of mind. He's kind of been popping out more on social media. He's got to be healthy, right? Like, and I think that's the key. He must be healthy, because when he was hurt, no tweets, no Instagram, nothing.
No,
like, this guy went into lockdown. He's showing his workouts. He's shooting 65s. He's doing AMAs on his girlfriend's Instagram account. Like, he's out there now. And usually when, you know, I'm just saying, when Brooks shows up publicly, he shows up.
Yeah, I think he was the wounded beast. And I think as a result of it, he couldn't be that cocky and you know, be his usual self. And I think that 65-65 is huge from the weekend. And definitely look for something here. I think one of the things is the amount of rookies that are in this field, including Canadian Nick Taylor. I mean, we mentioned Matt Wolf that was here, but a guy like Cameron Champ is one of the 26 players that are making their tournament debut. Although he is a rookie, I think he is probably a more exciting player for me to watch than just Bryson. I mean, Bryson's great. He's going to bash some shots and stuff like that. I think for me, even though he hasn't proven it yet with all the wins and stuff, I think it's more exciting for me to watch how Cameron Champ plays this golf course. And again, you know, you talk about those longer players and taking advantage of, you know, the golf ball being in the air. I want to see what Tony Finau does. This is a guy who's been in the mix a few times. Yeah. So, you know, does he all of a sudden ramp up an extra gear in this? Does, you know, this could be kind of a breakout one for him. So it's those players that kind of have those extra little gears on certain things. I worry for a player like a Colin Morikawa, great for the approaches. I don't know if strong enough off the tee, and again, being a rookie, but, and even Sungjae. You know, we haven't talked about Sungjae a lot.
He's disappeared. He's kind of fallen off. I think COVID destroyed Sungjae. He was one of our, like, most concerned, right? Like, was he just on this heater going in? And, like, that's why he kept playing, because weeks off hurt him. And since he's come back out, it's been tough. It hasn't been good. He's gone through, like, four caddies, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, here's a guy who's making his tournament debut, Scottie Scheffler. I mean, there's a bunch of stories that are in there. Again, I'll eliminate some of those rookies. I'm not expecting a lot from them, but I think there's a lot of entertaining storylines there that if we see them play well, and not just on the broadcast, but on social and stuff as well. Obviously, you know, Max Homa's in there. He's playing. Eric Van Ruin, who is a guy a lot of people are paying attention to. Andy Ogletree, who's was a U.S. amateur champion. I mean, I'm interested to see how this guy plays. These are not the storylines that everybody's going to be watching, but I think these are the guys that kind of sprinkle into the mix of that top 10. And, you know, they become threads that you're going to follow and support the regular cast of characters that are out there. And, you know, this is what makes the Masters great. You've got 92 players in the field. You know, should have been 94, but obviously Neiman and Garcia are out with COVID.
I called that for the record. I said Houston Open is going to have an effect. I don't know.
But you know, we also could see some other storylines here too. We're talking about players that, you know, are introverted, maybe have a chance to, you know, do something to sort of pop back into, you know, mainstream talk. What's going to happen with Spieth? You know?
Missing the cut. Like, I have zero belief in this guy going.
Yeah, but I mean, what's that faith based on, though? Is that based on the actual results, or is it actually just on perception of what everybody's talking about?
It's just like every time you watch him, there's just, he can't avoid those big mistakes. And maybe this is a place that he plays well at. So who knows? I just have I can't go into Augusta saying, like, yeah, watch out for Jordan this week, right? Like, there's nothing.
Well,
there's
no
signs
that say that.
And I'm sure if we go through the stats, we're going to be able to say, like, for example, like you talked about Cameron Champ. If you look tee to green, this guy's been playing great. What I would say is going to hold him back is he's 252nd in putting this year.
Yeah,
right. But, like, there's 100 plus guys there that don't even have status fully on the tour that are beating you. Like, that's not going to work out at Augusta. And I'll mark my words, because at the end, if I'm wrong, because I like Cameron Champ, I think he's a good dude. In terms of, like, other storylines like that, I just don't trust a lot of the rookies out there. As I said, I'm going to look at guys like Matt Wolf that I think get too excited, especially Augusta. This is their first week. I think older rookies are different stories. Like we're talking about Taylor.
Do you think that Wolf's experience at the US Open is going to help him here as far as being in that mix and having that pressure on him and going through that, you know?
No. And the reason why, and I'm sure you can, you've walked into, would you say 1,000 different golf courses in your life?
Stood
on the property of 1,000 different golf courses. I'm sure Matt Wolf has actually played Augusta National before. But you can say, and maybe I'm wrong, but I would take a guess that of the 1,000 golf courses, you can distinctly remember the feeling when you first walked into Augusta and the aura around it, right? It's different. It's different than other places. And caddies say it, players say it. Like it's just the pressure gets all of a sudden the walls start closing in at Augusta and the trees start closing in. It's different around there. Yeah. I think when you go to your first US Open and you get into contention your first US Open, you know, did Harding Park, did he think about that place growing up? No, he didn't even know it existed growing up.
No.
Right? And now, or was that the PGA Tour, PGA Championship?
No, it was PGA Championship.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
But that's same, where he same, was in
same
the
type of, Yeah, but same yeah. type of effect there. I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, whether it's Wingfoot or Harding Park, you know, being in the mix there, you're right, is different than the iconic Augusta National. It is a different pressure cooker, whether you're the fans are there or not, whether you think about it or not, whether you admit it or not, which is an interesting point, you know. Yeah, but I think that the difficulty there, you know, it's not the tee to green. It's not the tee to the fairway. It is the fairway to green to put yourself in the positions and then dealing with those surfaces, because they are definitely, you know, one of the most complex surfaces in the world. And I mean, I always laugh because I think of a golf course like North Berwick in Scotland, where they have, you know, this Brits hole with, you know, two sides with a big saddle in the middle. And I think of how ridiculous that green is. And then you go to Augusta National and there's 18 of those.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. And I think you talk about the greens and around the greens, why people like Bryson might have a tough time because his wedges are so long. I think people don't realize, like, it's just a different beast, that golf course. And I do think the thought process right going down the end, and Tiger literally talked about this today. He had to pull himself back on 18 last year because he was already thinking about the green jacket. He's like, I got to make two putts from there.
And
this is a guy that's won 6 green jackets, and he had to think about that. So now imagine a Matt Wolf.
Jack's won 6.
That was a Freudian slip. He's going to win this week. If that's Matt Wolf, Matt Wolf might be thinking about that on 12, and maybe that's what happened with Frankie last year. Yeah. Who knows, right? So we have no idea. For me, I like the story of the rookies. I don't see any rookie really getting into contention. Why don't we talk about a couple bets that we want to make, and then maybe go into our draft really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, trying to pick out some players here. I mean, I think I've changed my mind a little bit over the last little while. I mean, starting to dig through the odds, things changing too when you start to consider the conditions and stuff like that. But what do you want to do? You want to do a draft for maybe something like maybe we'll have a little bet. I know I'm down a couple of bets and I haven't fulfilled those, but I there's got to be something I can fulfill.
Yeah, we definitely got to do a draft. And I think there's no way people answer. If you look at the menu this week for this dinner that they have going on. So it's a weird menu, but I love it. They start with some sushi. And for the record, we just talked about making our bets, like what money we're going to bet, and we're talking about food. So that's how good this podcast is at staying on track. So they're having the Augusta roll, which is some nice sushi with some spicy tuna. Sounds delicious for dinner. They're doing some prime steak and chicken fajitas. And they got a nice dessert afterwards. But for me, what I went all the way past that right to the wine menu. And I was like, what's going on here? Because that's what I like to know is, like, what are the elite drinking and how much money does it cost? So this bottle
your eyes got off the churros with the chocolate sauce. That was kind of where I stopped.
I passed all that. This 2015 Hillside Select Cab Sauv made in Napa Valley, about $480 Canadian if you want a bottle of that. that must just taste like gold going down your gullet there.
I would have to think so. It'd be very interesting to actually be in that room and to see how much and who actually consumes a lot on a Tuesday night. I mean, yeah, I know it's true. Early in the week.
Who of all the winners that are going to be there, who gets the drunkest? And you're right.
Oh, Fuzzy Zeller by far. I mean, it's not even close. I think it's going to be that older group. Those guys are just going to be, you know, hammering it because they're not playing. They don't care. They're just doing their thing. They're telling their stories. They're, you know, they're holding court.
Let's say active player that is playing this week. Who are you taking? I'll go first. I'm taking Fred Couples. Fred Couples screams to me the guy that's last at the bar, but the first guy you see at breakfast. You know, he hangs out with the boys at night. He gets up with the men in the morning. You would never know he was hungover, even though you watched him drink, you know, $1,500 worth of wine the night before. so I'm going with Freddie. Who do you got?
I'm going to go Charles Schwartzel. I'm going to take the South African, knows his way around wine, probably, you know, partakes in it a little bit. I think, you know, he's a small guy, but I think he could put it back pretty good. So I'm gonna go Charles on that one. And hey, you know what? He can always hide a bottle in his bucket hat that he wears these days.
I love that hat. All right. Well, you know what? It actually makes more sense for us to do our draft first before we actually give off like bets that we like and who we like, top 10 or missing the cut and things like that, because that might sway our results. Why don't we say, well, we'll play for a bottle of wine this time. I think you'll actually be able to
cover
your bet on this one. It won't feed into next year. So we'll play for a bottle of
Not that one.
We'll set a limit. We'll call it a $30 limit, a choice from each other, and the winner wins a bottle of wine. You in for that?
I am in for that. That sounds like a great bet.
All right. Why don't we do our draft as per usual? What we do on here is we each pick three players. It goes back and forth in a snake draft style. Their last pick has to have 100-1 odds or worse of winning. So Scott, I'm going to, since I've won all of them this year. No, yeah. I'm going to hand it off.
Oh,
I want you to have a shot of winning for once. So why don't you go first? Who's your first pick?
All right, my first pick is Justin Thomas. He's going at 12-1 right now. I like him for a lot of things. The biggest thing I like from him right now is just how he's putting. I mean, that tends to be a weakness in his game a little bit. I like the work he's been doing with John Graham. I think just everything is there. We saw that even at, Sherwood. He had some wayward shots that were out there, but short game has definitely got it together. And I think he's a guy that not only could he win one, he's a guy who could win multiple green jackets over the years. So I'll start with JT.
I like it. I got to stick with this guy because I've drafted him twice this year and he's won me both of them. So sadly, what a shock. What a hot take this is going to be. I'm going to take Bryson my first pick. He's the favorite. He's saying all the things he says. I don't want, like, if you said to me your option is winning the bet or Bryson missing the cut, please, I would take Bryson missing the cut. I think that the storyline behind Bryson missing the cut would be unbelievable. So I'm going to take Bryson. And then with my second pick, I said I like this atmosphere for him. So I'm going to take Rory. I think he's in a good spot for it. So I'm going to go Rory with my second pick. Who are your next two?
Well, you know what? I can't go past a couple of guys near the top of the leaderboard there. And you know what? I think, you know, they might need a tailor to take care of the coat for this guy and to really fit it properly, which I'm sure they will be able to do. But 65-65 last weekend, you know what? Brooks, I think it's time. He's going 16-1. You know, we got to protect those guys up there. Right? And, you know, it'll be interesting to watch. It'll be interesting to see how, if he gets in the mix early on, how he progresses during the week and whether he can finish it out or not. And, you know, how he acts and how he, you know, you talked about it, him, you know, being nonchalant and saying it's no big deal or whatever. But I think secretly, if Brooks could win something like the Masters, that'll be a huge deal for him.
I just can't picture him in the jacket. You know what I mean? Like,
it looked like the Incredible Hulk trying to burst it out. What I would wonder is whose jacket will they let him use for the ceremony? That's what I'm more interested in.
We'll to give him Angel Cabrera's from back in the day. It's just his whole physique, his style. I just can't picture it. The other guys we're talking about here, I can see them putting it on, but I don't know. Obviously, you'd put it on and love it, but that's an interesting one. Okay, so Brooks is your next pick. You got another one, and then I'll go, and then we'll do our 100-1 odds.
Yeah, I mentioned him earlier. Part of the reason, reasoning why I like him or whatever, but Xander Schauffele. I think, he's won a tour championship. I think he's just got a lot of the tools. I think he's geared up for this, and he's just fun to watch. And I don't think he gets the attention that he deserves. A lot of people will be talking about a lot of other people this week. A lot of the main cast of characters. And I think he just kind of slides in there and has that opportunity to win a jacket.
I love it. Okay. So my next pick, and then I will do my 100-1. I'm going to go with Bubba. I think Bubba's in a weird, he's been open about what's going on with his mental state. Yep. I think he's becoming comfortable with who he is. And I was watching an interview today where he said, he would get very nervous around here because of all the people and the fact how close they were and that these people aren't going to be around. And I think Bubba can just go out and be himself. He plays that fade. If his putter gets going, watch out. I think his odds, clearly people are throwing money at it, because other than this tournament, you will not find Bubba at only 31-1 odds. So that one I had to go with. I like it. I'm going to throw out names because it doesn't really matter, but other guys like Jason Day and Tiger, those are some good odds in the 40s. So I like that. But my over 100-1, I'm going with our guy, Corey Connors. I got him on a top 10 this week. I think him and Peppers have been planning how they're going to attack this golf course for months. They've been talking about it. I know Kyle's been on site basically since Saturday. They're ready. They played well in their first loop around there. They got experience. They're comfortable being out on the tour. They've earned their spot. They don't have to worry about week to week anymore. The first time around was like, we got here. Now this time around, it's like, let's do some work. So I really love the odds on Corey Connors' top 10 this week. So there's my last pick. Who's your
honor to win? Those are pretty solid for sure. And like I said, Bubba, a little bit more comfortable, just got that Ping lifetime contract. So you're right. He's in a good frame of mind that way. And I can't knock you on the Corey stuff too. I mean, obviously he's been here first as an amateur, and then it was a little bit of a whirlwind when he showed up the last time. So maybe not fully focused on getting the job done after a big win. So he's probably pretty comfortable. For me, I'm looking international, just like you are, as far as the 100-1. I'm trying to flip back and forth. I think there's some surprise that's here as far as who could be in the mix. I have to go with Shane Lowry, though. I was going to go back and forth between Cam Smith and Shane Lowry, but I just like how Lowry's got a little bit more horsepower off the tee than Cam Smith. I think there's just an opportunity there. He's right at 100-1, and I think that's going to be my guy.
Yeah, there's some good names in there. Kevin Kisner has been the first guy on site. I don't know if people are aware how the numbers for the caddy bibs work, but the person who won the year before gets number one, which is Joe LaCava this week and with Tiger Woods, and Kevin Kisner, number two out there. He's the first one on site. You're showing me your little bear with a number one caddy bib on it. That's pretty cool. When did you get that thing?
Picked that up in 2012 for my daughter, and it was actually funny this week because, being Masters week and all, I popped in my office, and it was snuck onto my desk as a sign that it was Masters week. So that was pretty thoughtful of her to do that.
Yeah, it's got to be a cool thing. Well, why don't we grab a quick break? I know you have a little bit of a game for me. I quizzed you earlier on, Jeopardy stuff, and now we're talking money. Maybe it's my understanding. It's a game called Guess the Check. I'm gonna do awful at that. Then we'll hit our mailbag and wrap it up and looking forward. I can't wait. I took Thursday, Friday off from my day job because I'm just going to sit on the TV all. I can have three screens going. I got the iPad going. I'm going to watch one group on there or one player, every shot on there. I'm going to have my computer going over there. I'm going to have the TV on.
Amazing. Gonna have a text chain going, probably.
Oh yeah, yeah. You and I might get going. Maybe get a nice bottle of Bailey's for the coffee in the morning, and just kind of, just keep it going all day. I can't wait.
Yeah, well, the thing is with the coverage, being the short days, they're obviously doing the crossover on both sides. So yeah, they've got them squeezed in there. So we're gonna have a lot of coverage early on and intense all day.
Yeah, before we actually go to this break, let's just talk about that because there's some interesting thoughts around this. For example, Tiger Woods on the first day tees off around 7:30, I believe, in the morning. Mm-hmm. My understanding is Tiger Woods needs to get up minimum 4 hours before a tee time. That is a 3:30 wake-up call for Tiger Woods. That could be tough. I don't think we've thought about this. Yeah. And he starts on 10.
Yeah, I think he's used to that. And you're right, that 10 start is a tough one. I mean, Justin Thomas talked about it in his Tuesday press conference and said, you know, he's going to start on 10 on Friday. But he said, you know, trying to start off the day having to hit a snipe hook is definitely weird because it puts your swing in a different frame of mind as far as what you're trying to do. And just as far as from a feel perspective, whereas if you're playing normally and you're starting on the first tee, you get a feel for your swing,
The first tee you can hit anywhere, basically. Right. You just miss that bunker and you're fine.
Right. So you can make some adjustments, whereas all of a sudden your first shot is something that's not normal. So you're right. That could be interesting for these players. It's going to be pretty tight. They're going to be warming up in the dark, which they're used to. They do that. But yeah, it could be a long week. And here's the thing. If we do have, you know, some inclement weather come in, it looks like the worst weather will be early on. This could really have an impact. We might end up with a Monday finish as well, just because we don't have a lot of daylight to work with.
That would be tough. A Monday finish. That would be a tough sick day at work for a lot of people. That's for sure. Well, let's grab a quick break. Let's come back with your little game and what's the mailbag. All right, Scotty, you have a game for us. Why don't you explain it? And I need some help on this. Go ahead, all though. Right. This sounds crazy.
I'll try to help you out. You know, just looking through it, all the different trivia and stuff overall. And one thing that you always note about professional golf is how the purses have incrementally got higher and higher over the years. So I kind of looked at the winners of the Masters over the years, how much they made. And so I just randomly picked out some years, went back, looked to see what the first place checks were. And I thought, okay, you know what? I'll pick five and we'll see how close you can get to what the size of the checks are.
But sure.
We'll do it in order. How's that?
Sure.
For a bonus, you can guess who the winner was, which I think you should be okay on a few of these. Should be. Should be.
Let's go.
We'll see. All right. Let's start with 1934, the very first Masters. What do you think the winner made in 1934?
Oh, $7,000.
$1,500. And it stayed that way for many years. So this gives you sort of a frame of reference.
This is how bad I am at trivia. I don't know who the first winner of the Masters is.
Horton Smith.
Horton Smith. Of course, yeah. Horton Smith.
Yeah. He was in grade 11 when I was in grade 9.
He had a really good short game. Sure. I heard his driving was what they were worried about going into the week. But, you know, him and his caddy found a small adjustment on his swing plane, and they really got that launch angle up to the right number.
Definitely. Yeah. They were working hard on that.
They had the protractor. Back in the day, they have a giant protractor that laid right beside the ball, and the caddy had to get really close, and he had to see where it went on the line. And they got that up to the right launch angle.
And I heard during his press conferences, all he had to do was he kept being asked questions about Gene Sarazen the whole week.
Yeah, Gene.
All right, let's move on here. 1960. What did the winner make in 1960?
Okay. So.
So we're at 1500 in 1934.
I'm going to go 12,000. And was it right?
No, but you're close. You're get. I mean, it's going to be hard to get the exact number, and you can't expect any. I mean, if anybody rattled off the exact number, I would say you're a freak or you're cheating.
Or there's Scott McLeod.
Yeah, that even wouldn't happen. I mean, when I went back and looked at some of these numbers, I was kind of surprised by themselves. But 17-5.
It's pretty good. Okay, I was somewhere. I was like, I want to go 15, 20-ish, and I understand.
Yeah, you're in the range.
Okay, so I'm going to get closer. My guess, Arnold Palmer, 1960?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. There you go. All right, up to 81. So we're 21 years later. The check in 60 had been 17.5. At 21 years later, what are we up to for first prize?
Money hasn't gotten big yet, but I'm thinking it's got it. I'm going to say 35.
Getting there. 60. You're right. We haven't gotten into big TV.
Damn, I'm underselling it.
Yeah, we're not into the big TV money yet, but we're getting there. And who do you think picked it up in 81?
Gary Player.
Tom Watson. So another strong player in a similar era, that's for sure. But yeah, 60 grand. All right. We're going to get up into the money now, because we're going to be talking about TV money. You should be able to, one, get who it is. I'm not sure if you'll get the dollar amount, but we'll see. 1997, big championship, obviously historic. A lot of people are really familiar with that.
Tiger Woods.
You got that part right. That's the easy part, right? How much do you think he made for that first victory?
This is real hard.
And you got to think about, yeah, and this one's hard for two reasons. One, this is Tiger's first win, so we haven't gotten into the big TV contracts yet, but we're getting up to it as far as we're in the 1990s at this point. So obviously sponsor money is getting up.
Yeah, there. I'm going to go 300,000.
486, which I was surprised by. I thought I was more in that range with you. I was thinking, you know, I was thinking 320, 350. I was surprised it was close to $500,000 in 1997.
That just shows, though, like he, you know, back then he had an effect quick, right? Like what was it a definitely. Year prior must not, or a couple years prior must have been much lower still.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Easy one. Similar answer, 2019. You know who the winner was. That's an easy one.
Phil Mickelson.
Yeah. No. What do you think Tiger Woods won in 2019 for first prize?
I think it was like 2.2, somewhere in there, 2.25.
Close, 2.07 million. So there's the escalation. You know, you're going from 1934 to 2019. You're going from $1,500, which, you know, obviously you'd have to relate that by inflation. But over 2 million.
The money is much higher. Like, if we look back at that one in 97, like, that's only worth roughly, if my calculation is correct, which I'm just looking at a screen here, it's only about $700,000 now. Like,
yeah.
It's doubled. Like, that's a lot of money. Triple. But like, no, I'm talking about from 1997.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Like, it's probably doubled, but still, like, nowadays, you know, 2 million. So that's exciting. That's a cool little game. I would be awful at that. You'd be way better. I almost guessed Gene Sarazen for 1934, but clearly it's my boy Horton there. I don't even remember his last name. So
Smith. Horton, a really Smith. Complicated name there.
Horton Smith. Good launch angle. Good chipper. Struggled with the putter.
Exactly, 100%. So,
all right, Scott. Well, that's it for that game. We've hit Jeopardy. We've hit your game. Now let's hit the mailbag. Wrap up this episode, because we got to. People listening to this, they gotta get to the Masters.
Yeah, 100%. Mailbag was great this week. Obviously, everybody, you know, wants to know things related to the Masters. Some of it more trivia related, so there's not really a lot to debate there, but, you know, at least we can answer those questions for them. When was the last time Mike Weir made the cut at the Masters? Obviously, Mike's playing again this year as a past champion. And they asked about that. So he got his win in 2003. When do you think the last time was that he actually made the cut?
It wasn't that long ago. It was definitely within the last 10 years. And I obviously saw the answer here. It was in 2014, as you can see here, or you can hear here. I just want to give somebody a tip. If you can Google this and you would have been off way quicker than waiting for our podcast to come out. I think the better question here, now I'm asking better questions for our fans, and they're probably like, sure. I hate this guy, he does this all the time, is like, what do you think the chances of Mike actually making the cut this week are? Obviously, he says he's in good spirits and feels good. He's excited to be there. He doesn't just feel like he's, you know, a bystander for the first time in a few years, unlike Sandy Lyle. What do you think his chances are this week to make the cut?
I actually like his chances, believe it or not.
I'm going to sprinkle, I think.
Yeah, you know what? He's been playing well on PGA Tour Champions. Because he's been playing a lot and being healthy, I think that just, you know, it lends to him playing well here. And I think the pressure is off. I mean, although it's, you know, romantic notion to think, let's go out and win this tournament, that's not the case. So there's not really a lot of pressure on him. He's just going to go out and do his thing, which, you know, can easily translate into a top 50 finish. Now, they've eliminated the within 10 strokes. So we could end up with a few less players here for the weekend. And that's with 10 players within 10 strokes of the lead. But top 50 out of 92, I think he could clearly, you know, he could make this happen. So I wouldn't be surprised. Now, will he do something like he did in, you know, his only other top 10 was a T5 in 2005? I don't think he's in that range, no. But
I wouldn't be backdoor cut.
Yeah, a backdoor cut and something I would be comfortable saying, you know, in the 40s, you know, in the late 35 to 45, I wouldn't be surprised to see him in that range. All right, someone else last, when did the par 3 contest start at Augusta? Obviously, this is not happening this year. Quick answer for that one, we'll take care of this one really easy because there's really not a lot to talk about here. It's 1960. Par 3 course was designed in 1958. It was a compilation between architect George Cobb and Cliff Roberts, who was the, you know, chairman of the golf course, or involved with the golf course as far as being the president and the development with Bobby Jones. Related trivia, Sam Snead won that first one. And up till 2019, there have been 94 holes in one during the par 3 contest.
It's pretty cool. I saw a thing on Twitter. Some guy said his hot take about Augusta National is if he ever got to play there, he would want to play the par 3 first. And he said he stands by it. What are your thoughts on that? I'm kind of for it. I think you get out there, you get feeling okay. You're just kind of loosening up, then when you actually get to the golf course, maybe you're not as nervous. I kind of like it.
Either you're nervous or you're really defeated because these greens are so small on that par 3 course. Yeah, you know what? From a warm-up standpoint, yeah, you're probably
right. I'd rather
right.
that than go to the range. Like the Augusta National range has no, you know, nothing for me in the sense of like, oh, it's so exciting or different. It's a range, and I don't get excited about any range, but yeah. I think I'm all for
it. I can see that. I mean, if you're going to go there and you're going to play, yeah, you definitely want to be able to get out there and play that par 3 course for sure. It's pretty cool and it's neat to watch. And anybody ever has an opportunity, you know, and they have a chance to get tickets, if you can get it on the day they play the par 3 contest, definitely do. It's kind of exciting and it's a different way to see the players, see their families, see how they interact with everything. So, all right. Besides Mike Weir, has any other Canadian come close to winning the Masters? So again, another trivia related one. People could probably Google this, but yeah, George Knudsen was part of a 3-way tie for second in 1969. He's one stroke back of George Archer. And a bit of trivia here, you know, this year we've got four Canadians playing in the Masters: Weir, Hadwin, Taylor, and Connors. That has happened twice before. The last time it happened was in 65. Knudsen was part of that mix then, and playing, you know, with the four Canadians at the Masters. But neat to see. So,
well, we
all
have
right.
five next year.
Oh, well, we with Mackenzie. Yeah,
Mackenzie's going to be there, but is are all of them going to be there? Is Nick Taylor still going to get in?
I think we'll have to double check the qualifications.
Yeah,
that could be interesting. And I think you're right. I think the qualifications, it'll be pretty close. I think when we look at it from where the players are in world rankings, wins, finishes in major championships, I mean, it's really cool if you actually look through the qualifications. I put out a tweet, and I think I mentioned on this podcast before, Brooks Koepka is actually qualified 9 categories to play in this event. So,
crazy.
So you're right. We could see 5 Canadians playing next year. All right, let's get on to some things that are a little bit more, you know, we can actually talk about. Do you think the Masters will ever make players play with one model of golf ball? I got asked.
I don't. I think the amount of money the companies, all these golf companies, for them to now have one model of golf ball, it just, I don't see it happening. It would, I think it's just bad for golf, the branding and all that. It would be very difficult. And I think it would hurt a lot of golf brands drastically to do that. So I do not see that happening. And for them to do it at this golf course, I think it would hurt the best golfer one. I really do believe that, because what it would require is that people would have to be practicing with this golf ball. If this is the only tournament that does it, right? Throughout the year, just this golf ball for one tournament, right? Yeah. And that's just silly. That makes it gimmicky. This person's better with this golf ball than this person. And that just seems dumb to me. So unless everybody does it, then I don't believe they'll ever do it. And I think they're just too tight with the other brands in golf to do that. Like the Titleists, the TaylorMades, I just don't see them doing it and hurting those brands that help them.
Yeah, I think, you know, if there's a place that it could happen, it would be there.
I agree, yeah.
Will I think it happen? No, I'm in the same camp as you. I think it just, yeah, I think you're right. It turns the event into a novelty, and I don't think the Masters ever wants to be a novelty. They like their attention that they get, but they like their attention for their week. I don't think they want players, you know, worried about, you know, having to adapt their games for one golf ball. And then they just get into a lot of controversy. Like you said, you know, the golf ball could be suitable for one player, high spin, low spin, whatever the case may be. Tiger likes a different ball than Bryson or Phil. You know, why give one player somewhat an advantage, even if they can adapt? You don't want to make them adapt for that one.
Yeah, and you also give it to a guy that, like, now he just gets that dialed in for that week. And now every year it's like, well, that's his golf ball that he's better with than anyone else versus, like, he's just better. And that's the thing. Like, if everyone has a chance to get them perfectly dialed, I want everyone at their best, not one person with an advantage because this piece of equipment suits them. If that's the case, let's give everyone the same golf clubs, too.
Yeah, and you really don't want a player all of a sudden taking a month off heading into Augusta just because they want to practice with the one ball and then, you know, they're not playing the other tournament. So, all right, I put this out on Twitter this week. It's been interesting. I know where the responses have been so far. I put a different time constraint on my Twitter poll, but it was an interesting one that came in. Would you give up golf for a few years, like 5, for the chance to play unlimited golf for one day at Augusta National?
No, I wouldn't do 5. 5's too many. I'm telling you, your question sucks. I think the better question is, how many years would you give up golf to play and seeing where the, you know, the difference is, right? And I think most people would say, you know, a lot of people are going to take the least, but, like, realistically, how many? I think I could go. Could I go 2? I think I could go 2. I think I go 2, and then I just try to get into a lot of caddying. But, you know, I know a lot of caddies that just, like, they have more interest in caddying than they do golf now. So I could do 2, I think.
Yeah, that was that was sort of the thing. Most of the people would not do 10. I think the poll is at like 22% or something would do 10. I did get a lot of responses back from people to this person's question of, oh, I'd do 1 or I'd do 2. Nobody, I think, well, very few would go that long. You know, they want to play it. The other side, too, I mean, I've always thought about this, and I think I've done that poll before, is, you know, how much would people pay? To do that one day at Augusta National? What would be the real threshold? And you said it before, rack up the credit card
max
no matter
out.
What.
Max it out.
But would they really do that?
I don't. I'm wondering if I actually would really do it. I think my limit on my credit card is around 15,000.
Yeah.
That's pretty heavy.
That is pretty heavy. For one day, one golf course.
I'm thinking I'd go 2,000. I give you 2,000. 2,500 if they come back to me with the rebuttal.
I think it's a different answer if it's actually in front of you theoretical, right? If somebody all of a sudden comes back to you and says, hey, we'll make this happen. You cut me a check for 5K and you're good. You come down for the day, you know, you get taken care of and you knew it was real, then you'd go, all right, I can give up this and I can give up that. And, you know, I can pay it off over this amount of time. All right. You know, just to be able to tell my buddies
move
forever.
Some investments or
sell a few stocks, you know, the same kind of deal or whatever. So,
what about you? How much? What's the dollar? I need a dollar value. Is it five?
I don't know. I think it would be different if I hadn't been there before. I think before you go there, I think the number is higher. Mm-hmm. But after you go there and walk the grounds and be on it, I mean, that sort of takes care of the special factor for it.
Fair.
It's kind of like going to the old course for the first time. You walk it and you're like, there's value in that. There's value in seeing it versus just playing it. So I think the number would be less for me now than before. I mean, before, it might have been 10K. But now I'd say, you know, maybe a couple thousand, you know, and that's probably just because I'm jaded from playing lots of nice golf courses over the years. Or
fair
whatever.
Enough.
And Augusta National, while, you know, I have a lot of reference for the place, it's never been, you know, kind of my number one on my bucket list. So.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it is still number one, but there's other courses that, you know, I think I'd rather spend more time at. Just because of it. I think it's a golf course I'd love to play. And, you know, I think if you gave me that or and I'm dead serious on this. If you said you get one round at Augusta, you get a week in St. Andrews, you can play whatever course you want there. Give me the week in St. Andrews. I'd take the weekend in St. Andrews over. And that's just from being to St. Andrews. And if anyone hasn't been, that's.
Yeah. And that's right. See, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's the effect of having been there. Then you sort of go, oh, all right.
The other problem with Augusta National is you have to go to Augusta. And I'm talking about the town. So you got to find a place to stay by near there. So
fair enough.
One more question. Let's wrap up this episode.
All right, last one. And this one's fairly quickly. We've already talked about this player a little bit. But do you think Colin Morikawa stands a chance to win?
It's tough with rookies. We've talked about that. He's never played the Masters, never as an amateur or anything along those lines. However, he had never played the PGA Championship prior, and he went one for one there. So I think his game's in a good place. Can he?
We're talking win.
I know.
With a mohawk. I don't know if you saw his haircut in his press conference. He looks like Mr. T.
I'm fine with that. Maybe that's a power move. That's better than a 48-inch driver.
True.
I can't. It's the rookie factor. It sounds dumb, but like I think it's in putting. let's not forget Colin had a two-footer that he missed to lose to Daniel Berger earlier and then almost did it again when he ended up winning against JT there. So I don't love it. I don't love it at all.
That's a no for me. Again, I think you're right. Contending, and even contending is not really the answer. You know, being in the top 10 or 15, sure, I could see that. He's got talent and he's got ability, but once you have to shake a few of those two or three footers in that have a foot and a half of break, I'm not utterly confident that he's going to get that done and not put it off the green. So could be entertaining to watch. Is he capable? Yeah, but it might not be this year.
I love it. All right. Well, that's it for that. The mailbag. Scott, we have a few more weeks left of golf, which people might want some tip of the week, right? Like up in Canada, people are playing all around. I do know the Masters usually wants people to go find a golf course that's still open, so people might come out. The flop shot is a shot that you'll see a lot at the Masters. One of my favorite shots to hit. Like when the time comes, I love it. I think it's a hit a great one when we played the other day on
You did?
Yeah, on 9 at Smugglers. Oh, that was or was it 9? Yeah, it was.
It was when you weren't going to take on at first.
It was an influence flop shot. The guy behind me, all he did was flop. The guys we play with, all he did was a flop shot, and they were great at both of them. I think they were father and son, and that was just like he must have as a dad when his kid first picked it up. He's like, all right, here's how you chip. No, there's no other option, because that's the only shot the two of them did around the greens. It was a flopper, and then I saw it, and I was like, I'm ready. I'm going to flop this one. So why don't you give a quick tip of the week on the flop shot, unless you want me to do it at this point.
No, it's all good. Hey, you should, based on that. But I would say first thing for most people, even though you might get sucked into it, it shouldn't always be your first resort. You should look at your other options first before you have to play this. But that said, you're always going to end up in a situation where you have a lot of hazards in front of you. Maybe the pin is short-sighted on the green. So you're going to be put in some situations where you're going to have to hit this shot. So it's good to practice and at least know how to play it. The one thing I see for a lot of these people when they're trying to do it, though, I see a couple of things. One, they for some reason, they think they have to really swing down and hit down on the golf ball. I will tell you right now that when a lot of people do that, they tend to take loft off their club, and as a result of it, they end up shots that go too low. They end up digging the leading edge of the ground, and you know what? It just doesn't work quite as well. So one thing to think of is we're trying to keep loft on the club as much as possible. So a couple ways that you can do that: slightly weaker grip, ball position slightly more forward. Sometimes you also see people creeping their ball position a little bit too far back in some of these shots. And again, we don't need to be really precise when we're hitting this as far as striking rate at the ball, which is where people get into trouble. They all of a sudden start to, they hit some thin shots because they're really trying to strike right at the golf ball. We have more room than that to work with. We have bounce on the bottom of the club. So let's think of it as a plane landing, and we don't want it crashing. So we can actually sweep along the ground a little bit more in playing the shot. Keep your hands and arms soft. Try to make a fuller swing in doing this, but we have to have speed. And because we have lots of loft and we can maintain the loft on the club, we can have lots of speed and the ball will just go up and not go forward. So you can't be afraid of it. So the biggest thing here is, yeah, slightly forward as far as ball position, not a lot of movement as far as your body is concerned, long swing, lots of speed, and practice it so that you feel confident. The biggest reason that people fail in this is that they don't feel confident. Partway through this long swing, they end up going, uh-oh, this is going to go too far, and they end up kind of stopping what they're doing, and they get themselves in trouble.
And you know what happens? Stuff. You blade it when you do that.
Oh, 100%.
So here's my tip on top of your tip.
Sure.
One, when you're practicing the flop shot, make sure where you are aiming and what's in front of you, there's no cars. That is yes. Huge. My buddy who's listening to this, his dad was parked right beside the chipping green beside a first hole at a golf course. Uh-oh. And came out to a windshield smashed because of a ball. Literally same thing. Try and flop shots. The thing that I think the biggest thing that you touched on there, two things that I see people do. When you say add loft, people try to do that by gripping their club normally and then twisting. Ooh. Literally lay the club down. It's going to look like the club is up, like just laying there, the back of it. And then you grip it. And then the last thing, that speed thing of it's speed. The hands go quickly through. They're almost releasing really quickly through. That's what gets it up. And yes, you do need to practice this a lot to get that feel of how big, how long, like the backswing, how far those go. They are key to getting the lot of spin on them. It's a shot that requires a lot of practice for a shot that you're not going to use that much.
No, it's not. So
unless
you're
the guys
you're
playing with.
Yeah, for sure. Who obviously hit it a lot, so they're going to be more confident in playing it. So, you really shouldn't be practicing any shots that you, or sorry, you shouldn't be playing shots that you haven't practiced. So if you're going out there expecting to look like Fred Couples hitting a flop shot in 92 at the 12th at Augusta, high and soft in the air, if you've never practiced that before, it's not going to happen automatically. You have to find out how to do it, be confident and practice.
And have the right bounce for you too. I think that's the key,
true.
Right? Like making sure your wedges are fit. That's a great tip of the week. I love that. That's one of my favorite shots. I think everyone loves to hit it, but it is difficult. So practice it. I think that's it for us, Scott. We've talked enough. We got this podcast out a day earlier. So you have all this thought about, you've listened to this, you got your bets paid. You're not listening to this Thursday morning. As it comes out for you, when we usually come out, we got this coming out a day earlier, so you can, get excited for the Masters. We're excited. We can't wait. I'm going to be on the couch all day Thursday, all day Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and maybe Monday at this point by the sounds
maybe.
Of it. I can't wait. Scotty, any final thoughts for the Masters before we wrap things up?
No, everybody enjoy it. This is an unusual situation. We are going to have another one in 5 months or so, but certainly appreciate the fact that this one is happening at all. And you know what? If you want to interact with us on Twitter, I'm sure we'll be on there going back and forth, talking about the event, and we'd love to hear from you on there. So thanks for listening and enjoy the Augusta National Golf Club in November.
I can't wait. Well, that's it for us. We will see you all next week. Can't wait to chat then.
Some ocean in a day like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.